Hello and welcome to the latest episode of When Sky Invented Football, the podcast that thinks it's a fanzine. I'm Adrian Goldberg, founder of Britain's first national football fanzine, Off the Ball, and I'm joined as usual by John Nicholson, author of Can We Have Our Football Back? John, hello, how are you doing?
Great, thanks Adrian, how are you?
Yeah, nice to speak to you as always. And a couple of things I want to talk about. Football and homophobia, as yet another player comes out, but only after retiring. And John, you've written a great piece about that for Football 365. So we'll touch on that a little bit later on. But first, Scottish football. Now, it was dismissed by our guest last week, Chris Scudder, who has worked for Sky News and Sky Sports, as boring. Now, John quite rightly pushed back on that, but it was only a brief discussion. And as a lover of Scotland and as someone who appreciates football in all of its many and varied forms, I wanted to get under the skin of the Scottish game and move beyond the all too common English stereotype that all you get north of the border is pub football. So to help us on that quest, we're joined by Daniel Gray. Dan is the editor of a beautiful periodical devoted to Scottish football, past, present and future, called Nutmeg. He also wrote a book called Stramash, which is about getting to know Scotland through its smaller football teams. Daniel, hello.
Hello. Hello, Adrian. Hi, John.
Hello, mate.
Now, it's weird, isn't it? Just one of those coincidences. John is from Middlesbrough, originally, or thereabouts, now living in the west of Scotland. And Dan, you're also from Middlesbrough, but as I understand it, fell in love at a Heart of Midlothian game, and you never went back to England. Is that it?
Well, just about, yeah. Like John, I was born in Stockton-on-Tees, the home of the Friction match. But yeah, I came up to see Phil Stamp, a Borough legend, playing for Hearts, and kept drinking that day, and met my now wife in a nightclub around 1 a.m. and yeah, never really gone back, apart from every other week to watch the football at the Riverside.
Oh, really? So the pull of Middlesbrough FC strong enough to draw you from Edinburgh?
It certainly is, yeah. And that train journey down is one of the perfect moments in any month for me. The day gets worse from there usually, but it's a lovely train journey.
And John, you were keen to push back against Chris last week, and the podcast was really about something else. But the reason that Scottish football is often derided from an English perspective is that we see Rangers, and particularly in recent times, Celtic, winning everything. And the assumption is that below that, it just can't be very good. But you think it's really competitive below that level, John?
I think Scottish football is often criticised most by people who don't watch it. And that rather annoys me a lot of the time. You usually find when people say, oh, it's a pub league, the quality is terrible. They haven't really ever watched any football beyond occasionally coming across an Old Firm game or something like that. The light from Celtic and from Rangers does shine very brightly, and it tends to overshadow everything else about Scottish football. But there's so much more to it than just those two clubs. And what I think its great asset is that below that, you have no idea, really, who's going to win any game played between any two sides. I was looking at some stats earlier, and when the league stopped, Motherwell, who I think were third, they had lost 12 games. I think they'd won 14, drawn 4, lost 12. Now, if you've got a team in third place that's lost 12 games, that means, really, you know, there isn't any way ahead of the kickoff that you know who is going to win a game. It's very, very tight, very competitive, very down to earth as well. I mean, it's not that that doesn't exist in England. It does, but not in the top flight, or much less so in the top flight. And I think what Scottish football's great asset is also that it has never lost touch with its working class roots. It's still embedded, the grounds are still embedded in the local communities. They are not on distant, or by and large, they are not on distant wastelands near retail parks. They are still in the back streets of the towns and the areas of towns that gave birth to them. And I think for those of us who love football as part of society and community, that's what we get a tremendous sense of warmth about, I think.
And Daniel, before you fell in love in an Edinburgh nightclub after watching a Hearts game, did you know anything? I mean, this was, what, 17 years ago?
Yeah, I've been up here 17 years, yeah.
Yeah, did you know anything about Scottish football at that point?
I suppose you know it as an Englishman by what your dad tells you very often. So when your dad tells you about the great managers or the good at managing and the great Leeds teams and Liverpool teams, they're the bits and bobs you know.
How do you mean the great Leeds and Liverpool team? Oh, they're not in Scotland and, yeah. Unless the borders move south.
You've not seen the press conference. The Scots that played in those teams, you know, they were always thought of as Scottish teams almost. So there was the reputation of great players, but I didn't know much about the football culture that you get here at all. I'd been up as my 15th birthday present. My dad brought me up for the day to watch Hibs, actually. He said we were going abroad to watch a match. So I was aware of that. And my only other awareness would be through the Panini sticker book and the impossible romanticism of names like St. Johnston, St. Mirren, Heart of Midlothian through Panini. And it just seemed like a different and a more exotic world. I know the reality of that isn't quite, the word exotic wouldn't come to mind, but it is different. It is a different type of football, and that pleases me enormously.
So when you set about discovering Scottish culture and Scottish life through football then, where did you head? What did you find?
Well, like John, I can't drive, so I headed wherever ScotRail told me, really. But all over the country, down the southwest, Queen of the South in Dumfries, right up to Dingwall in the very northeast towards Ross County, and in the central belt in the old industrial towns, Coke Bridge to see Albion Rovers, then through to Fife to see Cowden Beath. Really interesting areas, post-industrial areas. What Jonathan Meads called pools, coupon towns, because we only hear the name of these places, Alloa, Cowden Beath and the rest, in the football results. They're not heard of anymore. Alloa isn't heard of for its great, great glass making. Cowden Beath isn't heard of for its mines. None of that exists anymore. So the football team is all we hear of those places. And actually, it's still the absolute centrepiece of those towns.
I remember an article we had in Off the Ball written for us by some East Fife fans, and they were reflecting on the town of Methil. And of course, the Methil is a town that's commemorated by the Proclaimers in the song Letter from America, or at least that kind of community is. And there's something very heartening about the fact that these places have become maybe deindustrialized and maybe in some cases depopulated, but football still provides that community focus.
Well, it's amazing in Fife, because I lived in there for a year in Pitton Weem, which is in Fife. And Fife, which isn't a really big place, it's just obviously, and most people probably don't know even know where Fife is, but it's a peninsula that sticks out north of Edinburgh, at the end of which is St. Andrews, the famous university golf course. And Fife has four professional clubs, clustered pretty much within 20 miles of each other. And that is very much typical of Scotland. Scotland is football mad. There are so many clubs. There's not just the 42 clubs that are in the professional leagues, but hundreds and hundreds of amateur clubs. I used to watch Pitton Weem Rovers, who played literally on a field, virtually overlooking the North Sea. It had been there on this little recreation ground for 100 years. 100 Wow. years of kicking a ball into a stiff northeasterly. And it was tremendous. And, you know, that is entirely typical of Scotland. Fife even had its own Fife Cup between the four Fife sides and occasionally one or two others, like a Burnt Island Shipyard. It's just, for those of us who love our industrial heritage and the culture that that went with that and the legacy, both politically and economically, these evoke ghosts of the past, you know. I find it very romantic. Perhaps I'm a bit of a soft old sod, really, but I do. I love the idea of Burnt Island Shipyard having a football team.
Well, as Daniel was going through all of those names of towns and football teams, Cowden Beath, Alloa Athletic, I'm tingling at the thought of those clubs and those places. But is the reality, Daniel, rather a bit more prosaic? You know, aren't we really just talking about clubs in rundown towns supported by not very many people?
There's always an element of that. And I think John and I both have the advantage of being outsiders. I've found sometimes in Scotland they put their own game down. But I must say there's a movement here in the last few years to stop defining itself against England and define the Scottish game as a different thing altogether. But yet, you know, there's grit there, definitely. You're not going to see hundreds of classic games if you go through a full season. But it really has something different. Just look at the example of the grounds in Scotland that you can go to. Capilo, Greenock Morton's home, is as close to an authentic, proper, almost Sabutio-like football ground left in the world. It is that beautiful, with terraces down the side, the view of the crane, the shipyards. Palmerston Park, home of Queen of the South, the biggest terrace in league football left, proper pylon floodlights, Somerset Park, Ayr United, a beautiful old relic of a ground. These are museum pieces. And so if the football isn't always great, you just find yourself looking around. The ground in which you stand is a thing of beauty. It's joyous, it's authentic. But also the grounds of Scotland, John mentions watching a Fife team there and looking out to sea. Places like Alloa, you just look at the hills if the games are rubbish. So you look beyond the ground in these places.
But it's interesting, Daniel, a couple of times you've said, you know, the football isn't great. Let's be honest, the football in the Premier League very often isn't great. Very often it isn't competitive. One of the great tropes about the English game is that, oh, well, the team at the bottom of the league can beat the team at the top. No, they can't. Not in the Premier League. They can in the Championship, which actually I think shares a lot in common with your description of Scottish football. But in the Premier League, if, let's say, Watford beat Liverpool, which they have done this season, that is a freak result. Most times, in most matches, the top four or five teams will beat the teams in the bottom seven or eight of the Premier League. And it's that dull and predictable. And very often, the games between the higher sides will see quite talented footballers cancel each other out. So, you know, don't do the Scottish football game down by that comparison yourself, you know.
Well, yeah. Well, the other thing is I'd much rather take the blood and thunder of Scottish football, which you get at all levels. You get this wonderful commitment than an attritional Premier League game by a mile. And the thing I've noticed in it, watching all levels of Scottish football, is that there is generally a commitment to that old-fashioned passing game that, you know, is almost Scottish folklore, really. That they do try and get the ball down at all levels. It may not always come off because the idea in the head doesn't match the ability in the feet, but that's there, and I don't think that'll ever go away, and that is lost a bit. There's a commitment to that. You won't see many teams set out with eight at the back. That, you know, there's no Tony Pulis football in junior football in Scotland.
I think also the other thing about it is when you look at the league this year, for example, Hearts and Hibs are the bottom two sides, and they're arguably the third and fourth biggest clubs in Scottish football. Now, that would be like the third and fourth biggest clubs in England being to bottom of the league. Now, that will never, ever happen. And that is the essential fundamental unpredictability of Scottish football, that you can rise up under a good coach with good recruitment, but you can also get relegated if you make a complete hash of it the way that Hearts have this year. And I often wonder what the word better, when people go, well, the quality of football in Scotland isn't any good, and it's better in England. I often wonder what better actually means. I'm about to start writing a book about this, about whether football used to be better, because I don't think football is an exhibition sport where you have to have the people with the most skills can do the most tricks. We go to football to see competition, to see people being competitive with each other. Now, I don't see that whether a player is better or worse is really anything to do with that. It's about how it's matched between the sides. And to just go back to watching Pitt and William Rovers, I watched them once come back from 2-0 down to win a game 4-2. And it was as thrilling and as exciting as any massive game. It genuinely was. And that is the beauty of football, is that it entertains at all levels. And I think that in Scotland there is, and I think Dan's point actually about us being outsiders is a really good one, because I do think it helps us see it a little bit more clearly sometimes. But there is an innate appreciation of the quality of football in Scotland in the way that it isn't allied to the corporate view of football that exists in the Premier League. You know, there is an understanding that this is about something more than seeing someone with Neymar-like skills. That this isn't the entertainment. The entertainment lies in a greater experience and in the, you know, the pull and thrust of tension of games, not through necessarily anybody being the best footballer in the world.
I had one of my best football experiences of the year, or of last year, in Paisley, watching St Mirren. I was there in Glasgow, which is not quite Paisley, for a weekend with my mates, and we could have watched Rangers play. We chose to go and watch Paisley instead, and there were about 6,500 in the ground. They were playing Hearts, so it was a bit of a relegation dogfight. We found a fantastic pub in Paisley, really lovely old school pub, great beer, great atmosphere. Then went to the ground. There's a great bunch of ultras at St Mirren. I'm guessing maybe 200 or 300 lads and lasses who get together in one section along the side, really just to make a noise. And they do, and they're totally into it. There's that sense that there's no rich oligarch pulling the strings there. And all of the people in that stadium could have chosen to support Celtic, could have chosen to support Rangers. Glasgow is only half an hour away on the train, and they chose to follow St Mirren. And that was where my heart was. I thought, this is the kind of football that I like. These are the kind of people that I identify with.
It's interesting you noticed how many young fans were there, Adrian, because that's been a real plus, whether it's an ultras group or a more sort of informal mates going along. You see that in the top of the game in Scotland and throughout the game. It's cheaper to go to matches. There are some great initiatives to get tickets cheap, if not free, by most clubs. And it does feel a younger crowd in Scotland than when I go down to Borough or to watch Borough away. It is younger, I've no doubt about that, which is really exciting for the future, I think.
I don't think it's also known widely that the top flight of Scottish football per capita of the population is the most popular league in Europe. It's watched by more people as a percentage of the population of the country than anywhere else in Europe. And England or the Premier League is eighth in that. I think it's something like, it has the sixth highest attendance with the fifth lowest population of 30 European countries. And that just indicates how popular football is. And when we hear it dismissed routinely as it is by fans of the Premier League, and I don't know why they would do that. I know actually a lot of lower league supporters don't dismiss it so easily because they understand the importance of local football to the civic pride of a place. But when we hear it dismissed, I often just think, you don't know. You don't know what it's like here. You don't know how endemic football is to the very fabric of the society in Scotland. You can go the length and the breadth. I mean, you can get to some seriously out-of-the-way windy places in Scotland, and Dan's been to most of them, I know, and watch football. You know, you can write about Wick Academy, you know, which is basically near the Arctic Circle, and all the way down to to Stranraer. It is as though Scottish football is like a kind of mycelium that spreads almost unseen across the whole country. It connects us all together, and it is the sort of this is the sport of the country. And I just feel as though this isn't often appreciated enough south of the border, and that's why we shout about it so loudly.
We can't ignore, though, can we, the presence of the two giants of Scottish football, Rangers and Celtic. And it seems to me that if you're a half-decent professional team in Scotland, you've kind of got a double bind on you, because if you're a half-decent English side, you know that if you've got a good quality player, the Premier League are going to come knocking and are going to take that player. Or even if you're a lower Premier League team, you get a decent goal scorer or a good centre-half, they'll be going to a top Premier League side very, very soon. If you're a decent-sized Scottish club, but not Rangers or Celtic, you haven't only got the Premier League vultures waiting to descend, you've got Rangers and Celtic waiting to descend. And my sense is that they tend to hoover up any half-decent young player who isn't destined for the Premier League. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think it's been the case for years. I've One regret for Scottish football, I have, if that's the right word, is that there isn't more positivity in challenging, particularly Celtic, in the last few years. Aberdeen is a club that has the potential to challenge and be a bit more aggressive in what they do. I wished Hibs, which is the club nearest to me, had spent a bit more on players instead of stands in the last few years. There's a bit of negativity about that to me, a sort of it's as if it's done, you know, Celtic are going to win it. That has saddened me in some ways, whereas the Scottish Cup has been a really fantastic competition in recent years with, you know, various clubs winning it. It's been all over the country, which is a very exciting thing, and it's still more loved than the FA Cup, perhaps. So that was a really good competitive event for several years. But yeah, I wish there was more positivity in challenging. You're right, players are hoovered up by the old firm, and I'm not quite sure without more distribution of wealth how that can really be truly challenged. But I'm not completely anti-Celtic and Rangers. I think to have two magnificent institutions in one city, world-known clubs, you know, 1967 Celtic and all that went with that, I think that should be celebrated for its goodness when it is good, because they have many, many thousands of normal fans that are just like the rest of us.
I think also when you look at how the finances of Scottish football are organised, and in fact, to stretch it out beyond that, how Scottish football is administered by the SFA, I think this is where we see most of the problems, really. It is run, I am pretty certain, and I'm told many times by people who have good reason to know, it is run like an old boys network, really. There's lots of squabbling, and Pat Nevin told me a really funny story when I was writing my book. He said when he was, because he was chairman at Motherwell, a chief exec anyway, and he found out that there was an additional UEFA payment that was due in to all clubs for some reason. It was a small amount of money, about 750 quid. So he said, oh, that's good. You know, we can invest that in, you know, facilities or something like that. And he went around sort of telling all the other clubs about it. And he said, like, at one particular club, he didn't tell me which one it was. I said, instead of spending 750 quid perhaps on some extra footballs or better nets, they bought a drinks cabinet for the chairman's office. And I thought that said a lot about Scottish football's organisation.
It's brilliant how Scottish football is brilliant despite this stuff. And it also weirdly adds to why I love it, actually. It's that sort of old school stuff. And I do wish it was run better. There's a great example of that at the moment. A multimillionaire benefactor has given a few million pounds to keep Scottish clubs going. But instead of targeting it at smaller clubs, which it should have been, it was equal. So everyone got 50 grand. Celtic got 50 grand. And it's that kind of... those things where you just think it's good here, but it could be so much better if you just sorted stuff like that out, fewer drinks cabinets and more distribution of things. But there's, on the other hand of that frustrating bureaucracy has led to a fantastic supporter ownership ethos here, which is no doubt what the future of Scottish football. If we can have a club the size of Hearts being owned by its fans, which was about to happen before coronavirus and will happen, then you know, anything's possible, really. That'll be one of the biggest clubs in the world to be owned by its fans. And that is here to stay and increasing in Scottish football.
You think that pretty much any Scottish club then could be support around it at a professional level?
I think it's happening already. Many of them are, and I think it'll happen increasingly. What we're seeing is owners that have had their day, they haven't quite got the money to maintain a club anymore, now doing more of a secure handover. So they have a supporter representative on the board for a few years. He or she learns the ropes, spreads that knowledge. It's a really, really sensible way of working. I think Scottish football probably works in spite of the authorities. I think little things go on at clubs. There's really good practice at a lot of clubs going on. And there has to be, because they're not financially viable. That was one of the conclusions I came to in writing Stramash 10 years ago, was that I set out to understand the economics, because I'd sit at Central Park Cowdenbeath and count the crowd, you know, 200 people. I'd add up, they've all paid 12 quid. If they've paid, you know, it doesn't add up, this. And I'd never concluded how it keeps on going. But there's a certain magic and a certain will that keeps it going, but increasingly innovation as well, which has got to be the future.
Do you think the fan ownership side of things, Dan, is rooted in old school Scottish socialism, in that not so much almost with a capital S, but with a, you know, how it's kind of societalism, if you like, the knowledge that we are stronger together, all has always seemed an innate belief in Scotland to me. And I've lived here half my adult life in one place or another in Scotland. I always feel as if there isn't that same, I was going to say individualism, that's not the right word I'm looking for, but there isn't that same big I am about everything. There is a fundamental understanding that we are a community and we're only as strong as our weakest elements. And I just wondered if you thought, because you've looked into this a lot more than I have, if you thought that that kind of socialist tradition has informed the fan ownership movement.
I think it has, because if you look at the areas it happens in, it's very often old coal mining areas, and there's no doubt there's a sort of practical, non-ideological almost socialism that doesn't come from Das Kapital, but it comes from the tradition of the autodidact miners, the self-taught people who knew they had to do things together to get somewhere. And it would never really be called socialism now or whatever, but that's definitely in the inherent ethics of these places. I think it just works for these people. They realise they'll lose something if they don't band together, and in this case, it's a football club.
John, you and I are old enough to remember the great Scotland players who terrorised England, the likes of Jinky Jimmy Johnston, former Celtic player, Davy Cooper, who was another great winger, Rangers player. You know, this sense that we in England have of great Scottish ball players. And I just fear that because of the globalisation of football, that those brilliant Scottish skills don't have the same ability to shine anymore. And I don't know whether it's because there are fewer young Scots playing the game. Are you going to tell me that those players are still there, the great jinky ball players, that they're just not hoovered up by the Premier League anymore because they've got a global outlook?
I think Graham Souness is still terrorising English football, only from the pundit's chair these days. The debate, and I'd love to hear what Dan thinks about this, the debate about the decline of Scottish players, you know, from the glory days of Dalgleish and everything like that in the 60s, 70s, 80s, is something that must have talked about hundreds of times. And it's very hard to put your finger on why we're not producing the same quantity of players. Where is it? Is it that kids have more things to do these days? Is it diet? Is it the fact that they're all on heroin? Who knows what it is? What do you think, Dan?
Well, you're talking really about what they call in Scotland the old tanner ball player. So that's someone that played always with a tennis ball, and someone, or whatever they could find, a rag or whatever, someone of that generation would say it's definitely the loss of street football, of playing with tennis balls on cobbles. It's a very traditional Hovis advert answer to give you, but I think there's definitely something societal in that. But I would also say there are plenty of Scots. At least 12 Premier League teams have a Scot in their first 11, and someone like Billy Gilmour at Chelsea is a wonderful footballer, and I hope he gets a chance to play, because he certainly is reminiscent of that small Scottish footballer that can't half use the ball well. Andrew Robertson at Liverpool is a very old-fashioned footballer.
Yeah.
I think that's why people love him. To see him hurtling down the wing, that's a real throwback to the past. John McGinn at Villa is an old-fashioned footballer as well. So they're definitely that. I think when you see Kieran Tierney fit at Arsenal, I hope he gets a good run in the team. Ryan Fraser at Bournemouth, another nippy Scottish footballer. So Matt Ritchie at Newcastle reminds me of that tradition as well. So they do exist, but it's the lack of Scots is just because the English Premier League is a cliche, but is a global division, so the percentage of Scots is going to go down as footballers from all over the world play in that league.
I was told by somebody working in English football at a coaching level that a lot of Premier League clubs rarely, if ever, scout in Scotland. And I was told that the reason they didn't was because their fans wouldn't want to sign a Scottish player because it sounds down market.
Oh, really?
And that's what they said. No, I don't know whether this is true. I just relate. He said, if we announce we've signed like a Scottish forward from Motherwell, it will not get a positive reaction the way if we've signed one from Belgium or from Austria will. He said, I must distinguish that he said that is what the management and the upper tier of management at his club would have thought the fans would think. It isn't necessarily what the fans would think, but that was what was assumed they would think, if that makes any sense, which is a terrible indictment.
Well, it also sounds crazy because, like, why would you turn your back on potentially great players, particularly if they're players who would be relatively well attuned to your culture and language if you were moving down south to England?
I was shocked by that. I was really genuinely sort of shocked, really, that that would be the case. And, he was certain it was the case.
Daniel, you talked about the lack of belief to challenge Celtic and Rangers from Scottish clubs. And again, John and I will remember the 1980s when Aberdeen under Alex Ferguson, Dundee United under Jim McLean won or challenged for European trophies. And it strikes me that the way that European football has gone, never mind football in these islands, but the way that European football has gone is that the dice are very firmly loaded now against Scottish football in terms of European football. A, in terms of qualification to get, for example, into the Champions League, it's almost impossible for most clubs in Scotland to aspire to that, given that Celtic and Rangers will usually occupy the top two spots, but also to do well in those competitions, that the competitions are seeded and tilted in such a way that it is really difficult to progress. Well, even if you're Celtic and Rangers, and if you're not Celtic and Rangers, you've almost got no chance.
Yeah, I remember that hitting me when Hibs got back into Europe a couple of years ago and the first came back. I think I got back from my summer holiday in June and the match was being played already, and it hit me how many games Hibs were going to have to play just to get in that Europa League division or whatever it is of 5 or 6. It's really stacked against the smaller clubs particularly. You've got to play and play and play. You know, it might as well be the Intertoto Cup for how early you start. So that doesn't help the profile of the Scottish game, definitely not.
You've got to play so many games in the Europa League, and that means you've got to have a huge squad. That means you've got to have a certain level of finance behind you. Again, just kind of robbing football. I mean, this is a more general point, really, but robbing football of its romance. The sense that anybody can have a go, anybody from any town can have their moment of glory.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's why we missed the Cup Winners' Cup, isn't it, as well? Mm. Or am I just having rose-tinted glasses, perhaps?
I love the Cup Winners' Cup. It was my favourite thing. It was it's a travesty that they got rid of that. It was, if you look at some of the finals in those, they're from teams which now would be considered backwaters and obscure areas of football. And it's not that long since Rangers were in the UEFA Cup final or the Europa League final. It's not that long since Middlesbrough were, really. So
feels it, John, doesn't it? Feels it.
It does.
If you're Dundee United, if you're Aberdeen, if you're Hibernian, it's very difficult to envisage that. I mean, we have the situation that even English clubs who qualify for the Europa League very often end up playing reserve sides. I mean, this crazy football world where you aspire to European qualification and then European qualification becomes detrimental to your Premier League status and you can't really progress in it. You decide to choose your best team for the league and so on. But look, I don't want to dwell on English football. We're here to talk about Scottish football. I know that one significant development, and maybe you can tell me a bit more about this, Daniel, was that as with the Premier League in England, the old Scottish Premier Football League was a separate league, wasn't it? And then it decided to fold itself back into the structure of Scottish football. What was all that about?
It's forever changing. I was looking back at Stramash last night before I sent you it, and I've put a disclaimer in there about the different titles, the different names of divisions down the years, because I had to do a flow chart at the time to just to understand how many different reconstructions and things there'd been and the names of divisions. And again, during this crisis, it suddenly came, no one was talking about reconstruction in March, and then it's become a big bargaining chip in coming out of coming back into football next season. And you think just perpetually reorganizing, the best they had was two divisions of 20 or so teams or 18 teams at the moment. One of the things that, you know, if you're going to talk about things you don't like about Scottish football, it's how many times you play the same team. So I go fairly regularly to Hibs now, and it genuinely puts me off, as I don't have a season ticket, the idea of seeing, I'm not picking on St Mirren in particular, but say St Mirren for the third time. So why they went into such small divisions. And actually, a sense of regional lower divisions might help here. You have a situation where by getting into the Football League, Elgin City lose money because they've got to get down to Annan and places like that before they had a derby every week in the Highland League. So there's an argue for more regionalisation, I think, financially. But yeah, there's an obsession with shifting the deck chairs, definitely.
One of the conversations I had, I think, with St Mirren's ticket office, I don't know if this resonates with you, John, the person who sold me the tickets for St Mirren, I had no problem getting hold of 6 tickets for the game we went to. But I said, oh, you know, I bet when Rangers and Celtic come, you're packed out. And they said, well, no, we aren't. They give more of their ground over when Celtic and Rangers come. But the person in the ticket office said that actually fewer St Mirren fans go for those Rangers and Celtic games than they do for the other games. I don't know whether it's partly because they're less competitive, because they'll expect to lose, or whether you just don't like going to your home ground when it's overtaken by the hordes from Glasgow.
I think that's probably quite common. I've heard of this quite a bit, actually, where people don't go to the Old Firm games, and largely from because they know they're going to get beat, but also because they don't like the kind of atmosphere that comes with it sometimes. Do you think that's right, Dan?
That's right. The phrase you'll hear is, I can't be bothered with their shit. That's as in sectarian singing.
Yeah.
That's the phrase you hear from a lot of people. So all of those elements you named, Adrian, that they're true, but that's a big one for people as well. Having to explain certain chants to your kid, that kind of thing puts people off. There's no doubt about that. And at the end of last season, Kilmarnock, who were having a brilliant year under Steve Clarke, had the temerity to say they weren't giving Rangers both stands, which they're so used to. They were going to fill with more Kilmarnock fans. And they got such abuse from Rangers fans and things who've become, had this feeling of entitlement that they should be able to occupy half a ground and things. And Killy managed to fill it with their own fans. And that was the kind of positive thinking that just needs to happen more. It was a big decision for Kilmarnock because they could have lost quite a bit of money by making that stand full of their own fans. But then the town got on board and they didn't lose money. In fact, they made money because more people came along. And that's the kind of thing I'd love to see more of. Just a bit more balls, really.
The sectarianism, for people who don't understand it, how does that work out in football then?
I generally don't think I knew I was Protestant till I moved to Scotland. As an outsider, it baffles you even more when you go to Hibs and you hear chants about things. You just think that, wow. So I couldn't ever try and explain the intricacies and what it means for people, but certainly it does put a lot of people off. I think that's just a universal truth.
I think also, as an outsider to it, it just is so puzzling. Obviously, I've got pals who have grown up here and would tell me all about it and what it was like from an early age. One of my pals is from Airdrie, and he's spent many hours telling me how he avoided having to back either Celtic or Rangers to avoid getting beaten up by one side or the other at school. But, I mean, he says to me, and I have no reason to disbelieve it, that it's still, particularly in the west of Scotland, it's shot through society, or at least it is felt to be shot through society, so that you might go for a job and you'll be asked which school you went to. And to me, that doesn't even seem like a kind of weird question. But of course, in the west of Scotland, which school you went to is a code for if you're Catholic or Protestant, because obviously the Catholic schools are All Saints, something or other, and, you know, whatever. So, I mean, I struggle with all of that terribly. I don't understand what anybody gets out of it, really, on either side.
What puts people off is the huge numbers of Old Firm fans, and not all of them are singing these things, and it's not throughout the game, and all of these disqualifies. But no, that's what puts, I think, most of the rest of Scottish football is fairly baffled and just wants to support its team or boo them off.
Daniel, thank you. I tell you what, I mean, I really want to go on holiday to Scotland as soon as lockdown is over and just collect as many football grounds as I can. I've been to Celtic Park, I've been to Ibrox, I've been to Easter Road, I've been to Dunfermline, and I've been to St Mirren, which I reckon is more than most English-based football fans will have been to. But there's loads I want to explore. So thank you for sharing that with us, Daniel. John, just before we go, I want to touch on the article that you wrote for Football 365, because another footballer another male footballer has come out as being gay. Once again, they've done it after they've retired. Just tell us who it is and what your thoughts are on that.
Well, it was a lad called Thomas Beattie who had started as a youth player at Hull City. He was from the glamorous town of Goole in East Yorkshire.
Nice cooling towers, if I remember correctly.
You always know you're in the north when the best thing about it is the cooling towers. And he'd gone abroad to America on a football scholarship, and he had a career in America and Canada and Singapore. And he just recently retired through injury, and I think he'd struggled quite a bit with kind of understanding who he was and everything. But anyway, he got himself into a good place now. And he's been talking about his experiences in football and how he felt as if he had to choose between who he was and playing the game he loved. So I was just using this really as a sort of leaping off point to think about the contrast in British football between the women's game and the men's game. Now, the women's game is very open and inclusive. There's quite a few players with same-sex partners, and nobody's bothered about it. It's just very relaxed. It's not an issue. It's just, you know, people are just accepting, and it's fine. But in men's football, it isn't. And my question really was to ask, is really men's football intrinsically homophobic somehow? Is there something about masculinity as expressed through football or who it pulls into football that puts people off just being who they are and allowing it to be evidence, not making a big statement about it or, you know, giving it a big trumpeting. It's just who you are. You know, you go home to your husband. Hitzelberger came out after he'd retired, and the lad from Leeds did as well.
Robbie Rogers.
Yeah, that's him. So they were there, they were playing there, but didn't feel free to just be who they were in public. So there obviously is a problem. There obviously is. We have 3,000 professional players in English football alone. A lot of averages would tell you that some people must be gay or bisexual in that.
Well, it's really interesting, John, that you and I chatted on this podcast last week about Black Lives Matter in football and were praising of the attitude of the authorities, the Premier League and so on, encouraging players to take a knee, the Black Lives Matter on the back of the shirt. But there is clearly something deeply reactionary in the world of football. If people who are gay, and as you say, there must be dozens of gay male footballers, there must be something deeply reactionary of the culture in the culture of the game if those people don't feel confident to simply acknowledge who they are in public, not hide it away, not necessarily make a big deal of it either, but just for it to be the fact of their life. And football, it seems to me, if players can only feel confident to come out, I'm not sure it's even about the fans anymore, you know. I'm not sure it's about the fans. But if we're in that situation, football's got to look at itself and address that situation.
I do think it isn't football's problem per se. It is a problem in football. But I don't think it's created by football. It is something to do with the culture of maleness, of masculinity. And that gets imported into football and is fed by football culture somehow. So you can be gay in the arts and in music and theatre, and it's almost obligatory, I think. But, you know, everybody's cool about it. Obviously, it's fine. And, you know, but in football, it obviously isn't. And people can say it is, and we can have a week of wearing rainbow laces. And I just worry that it's all a bit emblematic and not really making change happen, you know, and I suspect that is because it is to do with the culture of being male and how that works in football. And I think that's what we have to do. That's what we have to work on, really. That's what we have to change. It's also possible, and I think this doesn't just apply to gay issues, but I think some very talented footballers will get put off going into football as a profession by the culture, by this abance laddish culture. I know that is not. I mean, the best example I've got of that is, because there's a kind of anti-intellectualism to football as well, I think. And Pat Nevin tells a story where he was sitting in the dressing room reading a book when he was at Chelsea in the 80s, another fellow comes up to him and says, what are you doing? He says, I'm reading a book. He says, why? And I thought, that is so like anti-intellectual culture. But I just mean more broadly, you know, it's kind of, you know, are we putting off? Is the culture where you go? Or you can't, you know, you don't talk about that in the dressing room. That could, you know, who wants to spend their career around that kind of oppressive atmosphere where, you know, backs against the wall, lads, and all of that, which wasn't untypical. I mean, obviously, I don't know if it is anymore, but clearly something's wrong somewhere. And so we have to think about why and what we can do about it.
John, great to speak to you as always. Thank you. John Nicholson, Daniel Gray, thank you so much for your time as well. The editor of Nutmeg, he's got his great book out called Stramash as well, which is a journey through Scotland via its football clubs. And just to say as well, if you're listening to this and you are a gay footballer and you want a platform on which to come out, do get in touch. Drop us an email, goldbergradio@gmail.com. Or if you want to sponsor this podcast, drop us an email as well. In the meantime, you can follow John on Twitter. He's at Johnny the Nick. Daniel, where are you on Twitter?
At @D_Gray_writer.
Okay, brilliant stuff. Thank you both, and we'll see you again next time. Thanks very much indeed for listening.